Hello, and welcome to our program, Travel, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Jeff, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from various travel outlets here on OWL Radio. Let's get started with today's program with an article from the San Antonio Express News entitled, Port of Galveston Welcoming New Ships, Cruise Lines. This is by John Wayne Ferguson, who's a staff writer. The Port of Galveston is poised to experience another growth spurt in the new year. The fourth busiest cruise port in the United States had a record 2023 and is about to add new ships and cruise lines to its offerings to keep the growth steaming ahead. Here are three ways cruising at the port is getting bigger and changing heading into 2024. New ships. This month, the Norwegian Prima arrived in Galveston, marking the first time that that cruise company, the third largest in the world, has offered regular sailings from the island. The Prima, which carries about 3,200 passengers, is scheduled to make 20 trips from Galveston between December and April. Norwegian Cruise Lines unveiled its plans to come to Galveston in 2021 as the port was preparing to open its new Royal Caribbean cruise terminal. The opening of the new terminal meant that there were berths available at the terminal Royal Caribbean was leaving behind. The opening of the new Royal Caribbean terminal also set off sort of an arms race between the world's second largest cruise company and its longtime competitor in Galveston, Carnival Cruise Lines. When the terminal opened, Royal Caribbean berthed the Allure of the Seas, a 225-ton, 6,700-passenger ship at the new terminal. The Oasis-class ship was the largest ever to sail from Galveston. The Allure of the Seas has since been redeployed to Florida and was replaced in Galveston's lineup by the Harmony of the Seas, a slightly smaller Oasis-class ship. In response, Carnival, the world's largest cruise line, said it would also send a new mega ship, the Jubilee, to Galveston. The ship, which is branded with a Texas-style star on its bow, made its first sailing from Galveston this past month. The arrival of the two ships means there are seven ships operating out of Galveston at the same time. Royal Caribbean's Voyager of the Seas and Harmony of the Seas, Norwegian's Prima, Carnival's Jubilee, Breeze, and Dream, and Princess Cruises' Regal Princess. More passenger trips. The new additions will be a cherry on top of a record year for the port in terms of cruise business. Through the end of November, 318 cruises carrying more than 1.3 million passengers left Galveston. By comparison, the entirety of 2022 saw 324 cruise ships leave the port carrying about 1.04 million passengers. The port has now posted two record cruise years in a row after the COVID-19 pandemic drastically decreased the number of ships operating in the United States, even topping pre-pandemic levels. In 2019, the last full year of cruises unaffected by the pandemic, 297 cruises left Galveston. Money generated by cruising, including from parking, is responsible for more than half the Port of Galveston's revenue this year. Through the end of November, the port generated $14.8 million from passengers and $20.1 million from parking, according to a finance report this month. Expansion on the horizon. With more ships set to come to Galveston, officials are predicting another record year in 2024. There are already 389 cruises scheduled to depart the island in 2024, according to a calendar published on the port's website. The port is also in the midst of planning a fourth cruise terminal. In July, Del Monte Foods, a longtime tenant of the port, announced plans to close its warehouse and move to Freeport. The port now plans to turn Del Monte's location on the waterfront into a fourth cruise ship terminal. The port has committed as much as $5.3 million for the design of the fourth terminal and has estimated the entire project would cost $69 million. If all goes to plan, the fourth cruise terminal could start construction next year and be open by 2025, according to the Galveston County Daily News. Our next article is from the USA Today, and it's entitled, "The Numbers Are In. 2023 was a good year for air travelers," and new Department of Transportation data shows. This is by Zach Wichter of the USA Today. It was a good year for air travelers. According to the Department of Transportation, 2023 saw the lowest cancellation rate for flights in a decade. Of the 16.3 million flights scheduled last year, just 1.2% were canceled. It's a notable drop from 2022, which saw 2.3% of flights canceled, the second highest rate in 10 years. Thanks to the tireless work of our nation's aviation safety professionals, millions of travelers were able to fly safely and without disruption last year, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said in a statement. "We are glad to see this 10-year low rate of cancellations, and our department will continue to take every step to ensure air travel is smooth and safe for passengers in the new year." The holiday period was particularly smooth for flyers, with just 0.8% of flights canceled between December 17th and January 1st. The same period from the previous year saw 8.2% of flights canceled, largely driven by Southwest Airlines' system meltdown. The Department of Transportation is also continuing its push to get airlines to improve customer service and enhance protections for passengers whose trips are disrupted. Its airline customer service dashboard allows travelers to quickly see what their rights and entitlements are, depending on the type of disruption that occurs. This was an article by Zach Wichter, who is a travel reporter for USA Today based in New York. Our next article is from the AAA magazine, and it's in the Ask the Traveler section, and it's entitled, "Any Advice for Travelers with Disabilities?" And this is by Jessica Fender. In an ideal world, this column would consist of four words: go anywhere you like. In reality, the tourism industry has a long way to go towards welcoming travelers with disabilities. Thanks partly to a decade of advocacy work, though, we're starting to see notable improvements in more inclusive options. More than 1 billion people live with some type of mobility, sensory, cognitive, or other challenge, according to the United Nations. Fortunately, an ever-growing pool of destinations is actively working toward inclusivity. So whether you're after adventure, luxury, beach days, or cultural deep dives, disabilities need not to keep you home. Amsterdam, Singapore, Paris, Tokyo, and Las Vegas all rank high on various lists of the world's most accessible destinations. Greece recently added wheelchair access to more than 200 of its beaches. And Visalia, California was designated as the first ever certified autism destination awarded by the International Board of Credentialing and Continuing Education Standards. At least 80% of the city's tourist-facing staff have been trained in autism and sensory disorders. Before you depart, do your research. Disability needs differ for each person, says Alvaro Silberstein, co-founder of WheelTheWorld.com, a booking platform that specializes in accessible travel. And every disability is complex. The information we need is complex. As the first wheelchair user to complete Patagonia's famed and formidable W-Trek, Silberstein knows that logistics can be challenging for travelers with mobility impairments. His platform gathers detailed intel on lodging and attractions, trains people to use adaptive equipment, and organizes inclusive itineraries, including the first ever wheelchair-friendly tour of Machu Picchu. A number of travel agencies plan small group and private vacations for travelers with disabilities. Seabo Holidays, for example, specializes in trips for blind and partially sighted travelers. Of course, getting there is often half the battle, from terminals that can be sensory nightmares to inconsistently trained TSA staff, to rules that require personal wheelchairs to be checked. Airports are notorious pain points. Travelers might consider going by train, car, or cruise ship instead. There's still lots of work to be done, Silberstein says. The more people are aware that it's hard for a person with disabilities to travel, the more it changes the mindset of how services are put together. Our next article is from the USA Today, and it continues their year-long National Parks series. This one is entitled, Kings Canyon National Park in California brings you to Feet of Giants. Kings Canyon and Sequoia National Parks are often spoken of in the same breath. They even share the same website. They are two national parks, but they are managed as one by one staff, said Cynthia Kawasaki Yi, Chief of Communications and Management Support for both parks in California. Sequoia actually gets more visitors, more than 1.15 million in 2022, compared to just under 641,000 at Kings Canyon, according to National Park Service records. But each park deserves exploring on its own. Kings Canyon alone spans 722 square miles of massive trees and staggering mountains. Driving down through Kings Canyon itself is just a magical experience, views that you wouldn't get elsewhere, said Kawasaki Yi. Here's what travelers should know about Kings Canyon, the latest national park in USA Today's year-long series. What is special about Kings Canyon National Park? Like its neighbor, Kings Canyon is home to some of the tallest and oldest trees in the world, giant sequoias. The world's second largest tree, the General Grant tree, stretches 268 feet up in the park's Grant Grove. It's also the only living shrine to the men and women who have died in service to their country, and it's also the nation's Christmas tree, said Kawasaki Yi. How far apart are Sequoia and Kings Canyon? Kings Canyon and Sequoia National Parks are right next door to each other, and Sequoia National Forest. We're very intertwined, said Kawasaki Yi, so you get kind of a double experience in that. Can you drive through Kings Canyon National Park? Yes. Visitors can drive through Kings Canyon all the way to Sequoia on Generals Highway. If you're coming out from LA, you would go into Sequoia National Park, drive through both parks and come out towards Fresno, the closest major city to Kings Canyon, said Kawasaki Yi. She said the whole drive typically takes between an hour and a half to 2 hours, not including Cedar Grove, which is more remote. One flat vehicle entrance fee of $35 covers access to both national parks for 7 days. No reservations are required for entry to either. What is the best time of year to visit Kings Canyon? Kawasaki Yi recommends visiting in the spring or fall, but she personally prefers springtime for waterfall viewing. You get the really strong waterfalls with the snow melt, she said. Visitors will want to check if Cedar Grove is open for the season during their visit, as the road to that closes for the winter. In addition to being a popular access point for wilderness exploration, Kawasaki Yi said that Cedar Grove's views are unmatched. When you look up on both sides, you just see Granite Canyon, she said. Who are the indigenous people of the area? Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks are the homelands of the Mano or Manachi, Yokuts, Tubatu, Labao, Paiute, and Western Shoshone, according to the park's website, which lists the following affiliated federally recognized tribes. The Big Pine Band of Owens Valley Paiute Shoshone Indians, the Big Sandy Rancheria Band of Western Mono Indians, Bishop Paiute Tribe, Bridgeport Indian Colony, Cold Springs Rancheria, Fort Independence Indian Community of Paiute Indians, Fort Mojave Indian Tribe, North Fork Rancheria of Mono Indians, the Paiute Shoshone Indians of the Lone Pine Community, Picayune Rancheria of the Chukansee Indians, the Santa Rosa Rancheria Tachi Yakut Tribe, the Table Mountain Rancheria, Tehan Indian Tribe, the Tule River Tribe, and last, the Utu Gwatu Paiute Tribe of the Benton Paiute Reservation. Our next article goes back to the AAA magazine, and this one's entitled Trains of Thought. Strangers chatted, land raced past, the country came into view. This is by Frank Burris. Some years ago, my wife Bridget and I were living in Portland, Oregon, one of the western end points of Amtrak's Empire Builder passenger train, whose route stretches from the Pacific Northwest through the Rocky Mountains and across the plains to Chicago. Having both grown up in the Midwest, Bridget and I had flown or driven between Minnesota and Oregon many times. Then one day it occurred to me that the railroad ran directly from our new home to the town I grew up in, and that traveling by train would offer us an entirely new view of the country. So we booked a trip because, as travel writer Paul Thoreau once wrote, a train journey is travel. Everything else, planes especially, is transfer. It was late afternoon when we settled into our sleeping car. At around 5 p.m., we heard a whistle and the train began its slow forward motion. Behind us, the sun reflected off the glass towers of Portland as it sank towards the hills. The train rocked back and forth as we crawled through town. We crossed the Willamette River, then moved out into the industrial parks and finally into the Columbia River Gorge. Dinner was served in our private room. Afterward, we walked down to the observation car, which, with its big windows, was like a moving fishbowl for staring at the world outside. It was dark, and we watched the lights of small river towns dance across the water. Trains have always been part of my life. I grew up in a railroad town on the Mississippi River, and the tracks were just a few blocks from our house. At night, I could hear the long, low whistle as the engines came into town, and the clack of steel wheels as they rolled through. But I didn't ride trains until I was an exchange student in Italy. From where I lived in Bologna, I could get almost anywhere by rail. On weekends, I took day trips to Florence, Ravenna, Parma, and other places. It was the best way to see the country and learn about it. One day, as the train passed through the Apennine Mountains, I chatted with strangers who wondered where a young American who only half spoke the language could be going. Once I told them, they were happy to help me get there. On the Empire Builder, Bridget and I woke up in the mountains and went to the dining car for breakfast. Snow covered the peaks, and the sun came up bright red. Soon we pulled into Whitefish, Montana, where some passengers disembarked to ski. Those who'd forgotten about the time zone change had to abandon their pancakes and coffee and run to get their bags. After breakfast, we went back to the observation car, where we watched ice-choked streams flow over rapids below us. As the train filled with more people and we began to move again, our car grew louder. A video game beeped, a baby cried, people talked, but it wasn't unpleasant. We were traveling together, so it felt like we had something in common. We'd been brought together to make the same journey. Eventually, the train came down the mountains and onto the plains. Strip farms, an old man next to me said. He was a retired farmer from North Dakota. Every so often, he would blurt out observations to no one in particular, though I was closest. Cattle, ranches, horses. The land sped by. Between reading books, having meals in the dining car, and chatting with strangers, so did the rest of the day. Our car attendant told us he'd worked on the Empire Builder for 23 years. We met a biology student on his way back from Hawaii, where he was studying a nearly extinct bird. A woman from a Wisconsin farm who was battling colon cancer for the second time. And a retired Army veteran who was convinced we should return to the gold standard and rise up against seatbelt laws. After more than 2 days, we arrived at my hometown on the Mississippi River and disembarked. But as I look back, I realized a part of me never left that train. After the trip, I felt a stronger connection to our country. The size and texture of it felt more solid. I had experienced physical facts about the place by slowing down and seeing it up close. But even more than the land, I remember the people and their stories, which were as vast and alive as the country itself. Frank Burrs is an award-winning travel writer and the author of The Geography of Madness. Our next article is a short one from the AAA magazine, entitled A Lucky Snack, by Ashley Burnett. Sylvia Casares was born in the border town of Brownsville and traces her family heritage to Mexico, so it's no surprise that Tex-Mex cuisine has always been of keen interest to the chef. She would eventually gain fame as the enchilada queen in local publications while helming Sylvia's Enchilada Kitchen in Houston, which offers more than 20 different enchiladas at each of its two locations. These days, the co-author, with the late Texas food journalist Dottie Griffith, of the Enchilada Queen cookbook, St. Martin's Griffin 2016, is hard at work bottling her famous chili gravy and salsa for retail. Casares shared this recipe for sweet, crispy buñuelos, a Latin American street food that's considered a symbol of good luck and is traditionally served to ring in the new year. The recipe was handed down from her mother and grandmother, neither of whom ever put the instructions to paper. As I typically do with most of my recipes, I just worked on it until it hit the mark, Casares says. And while she doesn't have a specific good luck story from cooking or eating the flat, fried, cinnamon-flavored treats, Casares notes that she's been blessed with a productive, healthy life. I guess I could just say that the buñuelos have served me well. Our next few articles are from the Out and About section of the AAA magazine. Places to go and things to see near and far. The first one is Wild Things. Waterfalls tumble and streams babble through bigger and better habitats for crowd-favorite carnivores at the Fort Worth Zoo. After 3 years of construction, the Predators of Asia and Africa exhibit reopened last summer in more naturalistic environs, featuring dramatic rock formations, abundant grass, and more than 100 new trees. With the redesign, you can get up close to a Sumatran tiger and African lions. Only a thin pane of glass separates you from these majestic beasts. You can also view the lions from a walkway atop a waterfall. Other skilled hunters in the new habitats include African leopards, African painted dogs, cheetahs, clouded leopards, and striped hyenas. Plus, see African pygmy falcons, red-crowned cranes, and other exotic bird species in multiple aviaries. That was by Shiloh Urban. Next, Queue Worth the Queue. Every Saturday morning in downtown Lockhart, a queue starts forming outside Barb's Barbecue. Let me read that again. Barb's BQ, before it opens at 11. These meat lovers are all hoping they'll get to the front of the line before the barbecue sells out. Barb's quickly made several top Texas barbecue lists after opening late last spring, creating a big demand for what comes out of its pits only 1 day a week. Pork and beef ribs, smoked turkey, and smoked brisket. Boldly smoking out competitors in the barbecue capital of Texas, Barb's female pitmasters, Chuck Charnicart, Alexis Tovias Morales, and Haley Conlon, along with business partner Joanne Irizarry, promote inclusivity in a male-dominated culinary culture. Barb's also offers Rio Grande Valley-inspired sides, like its signature poblano green spaghetti, zesty salsas, and charro beans with house-made queso fresco. Another sign of inclusivity, the menu also features a vegan sandwich and slaw. This article was by Janice Turk. And lastly, spreading its wings. Spetzel Brewery, the state's oldest independent brewery, has been rolling out a Texas favorite, Shiner Bock beer, for nearly 115 years. The brewery is now branching out by distilling spirits at the new K. Spetzel Distilling Company. Nestled in one of the brewery's oldest cellars, the distillery is currently producing Shiner-branded gin, moonshine, and vodka from the same malts and artisan water as Shiner beer, plus other Texas ingredients like Rio Grande Valley grapefruit peel and ash juniper. Its world-class distillation system includes an eye-catching copper pot still and copper rectifying columns that were handcrafted in Scotland. On a 45-minute tour of the new operation, $25 per person, you'll get a good view of the still and other equipment from a large glass window in a new speakeasy. There, you'll learn how the spirits are made and taste samples. You can then purchase a cocktail or buy bottles in the tap room. Stick around for a bite, too. The company has opened K. Spetzel Barbecue Company, serving barbecue plates, sandwiches, and salads. This was an article by Amanda Ogle. You have been listening to Travel on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Jeff saying goodbye from Owl Radio.